All right, there are three parallels. We have the information in Matthew 22. There's also the parallel in Mark 12. And there is the information in Luke chapter 20. We finished up with the information as far as Jesus' discussion, his question and answer on tribute, but we did not deal with some of what I think are some of the important or practical lessons. First of all, I would suggest that we owe some things to our government, and that's true for anybody as they look at the government that they live under. When we study this account, if you remember from last week's class, remember the people came to Jesus and they said, is it lawful? Remember that word? Is it lawful to give? Well, that wasn't quite the correct word. Jesus says you need to pay. You need to render. This is an obligation that you have. A second lesson would be, what if Caesar, what if the government wants something that belongs to God? Could that ever happen? The government wants something that belongs to God? Worship. It's happened before. In that particular case, then we would say that the government is not going to get what it desires. But we do need to give as much and as fully as we can, consistent with the scriptures. Number three, as far as a lesson, giving God what belongs to him means we give how much? All. Ecclesiastes chapter 12, verse 13, we are to serve God with our whole being. Number four, if the Jews had given God what he deserved, do you think that they probably would not have been in subjection to Rome? I think that's very likely. So once again, we need to make sure that we have our priorities in the right place. And then someone made this notation, which I think is a good lesson. No man can accept all the benefits which the state gives him and then opt out of all the responsibilities. Some people like to live in that way, but that's certainly not going to work. Okay, looking at Matthew 22, we come now to the next question that Jesus was asked about. This is, of course, the question about the resurrection. Remember, the first question about taxation or tribute came from the Pharisees, the Herodians. That had failed, Matthew 22, verses 15 through 22. Now there is this second group of Jews that comes to Jesus, and these are the people known as the Sadducees. When you look at the different Jewish groups in the first century, you find some huge, huge differences. The Pharisees apparently didn't have too many difficulties with believing in miracles, but the Sadducees, they were opposed to believing in things like miracles. Acts 23:8 is one verse that we'll look at a little later, but remember what the Pharisees, or the Sadducees, excuse me, specifically did not believe in? They rejected a resurrection. They rejected
angels.
That would be the other big thing that they said, oh no, these creatures do not exist. So these men, Matthew 22, verse 23, come to Jesus on the same day and they ask their question. Sadducees have been referred to as a socio-religious party centered in Jerusalem, and I think that's a pretty good description. They're not mentioned too often in the New Testament. Matthew, of course, mentions them the most often. Of the two, Pharisees and Sadducees, which ones would have been the conservatives of Jesus' day? The Pharisees or the Sadducees? The Pharisees would have been the conservative ones. The liberals would have been the Sadducees. So if we think of it in terms of liberals and conservatives, that would be how the first century was arranged. We don't know exactly how they came about. It seems like about 150 years before Jesus came into the world, the Sadducees came into being. And if you saw the tapes, as far as the information for Vacation Bible School, you know that these fellows were some pretty wealthy people. You may remember from the video, they had houses with mosaic floors. That's pretty nice. You go back 2,000 years ago, a lot of people don't have that today. But they had mosaic floors. Sometimes in their home, they had a wine cellar painted in plastered walls, bathrooms with mosaic floors. They were well-educated. They would have been the people that controlled the priesthood, the temple. The Sadducees, of course, would have controlled the synagogues. So the Pharisees, the Herodians, they asked Jesus a question which would have been something that interested them, that being, of course, the question about taxation. But these fellas, the Sadducees, they come along and they want to ask a spiritual question about the resurrection. I think it's interesting as you look at Matthew 22 verse 23, and we'll read these verses in just a minute, but to kind of get us started, on that day there came to him Sadducees, they that say there is no resurrection. If you made a guess about the verb tense say, what do you suspect it would be? They say there's no resurrection. It's present tense. So this wasn't something these fellows just talked about every once in a while. If you talk to a Sadducee, more than likely, bang, They're going to talk about the resurrection. There is no resurrection. Or they're going to try to talk about, well, they don't exist anymore, but they would have tried to talk about things like miracles and angels and say, oh no, these things, you have some beliefs that are simply not correct. So just like people today who sometimes question or doubt the idea of a future resurrection, that was what these people believed in. Anybody know anything about the Sadducees as far as their view of the Scriptures? What did they accept or what did they not accept as far as the Bible? Well, you're really close. The first five, the Pentateuch. They said Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, Deuteronomy. In their minds, those books came from God. But when it comes to the rest of the Old Testament, well, you know, you can just go ahead and those additional 34 books, those did not come from God. Now, that made things a little more difficult. Anybody ever talk to somebody today that rejects part of the Bible? I've had some studies with people who would say, well, we don't think that Paul was inspired. So they just kind of scrap half the New Testament, or they only accept the writings of Jesus. That's kind of what it was like in dealing with these folks. If you look at the Old Testament, and I'm talking about the books outside of the first five, you find a lot of information about the resurrection or life after death. Remember 1 Samuel 28, verses 11 through 19? Saul wanted some information, so who's he go see?
Seer.
All right, that's Seer, the witch of Endor. And who communicates with him? Saul wants to talk to Samuel. All right. Was Samuel alive after death? Yes, he was. So, if the Sadducees allowed any books besides the first five, well, that's going to be a tough, you know, passage to deal with. And then there were some others. Remember David after his sin with Bathsheba? 2 Samuel chapter 12, verses 15 through 23. Did the child live or die? Died. But David, as he went through that situation, said, I'm going to go to him. Well, that sure sounds like that's life after death, doesn't it? That would have been another difficult passage for these men to deal with. Elijah and Elisha both raised people from the dead. 1 Kings 17:22, Elijah raised a child from the dead. 2 Kings 4, verse 35, Elisha also raised a young person from the dead. Then you have that interesting story in 2 Kings 13, verse 21. There is this fellow who dies, and his corpse is put into where Elisha had been buried. What happens to him? He brings back to life. Well, if you don't believe in any kind of resurrection, once again, somebody pulls out that particular story, and it's going to be very, very difficult to answer that particular question. So, prophetical books like Daniel chapter 12, verse 2, that promises a future resurrection. So, if you dismiss all of these books as the Sadducees did, that made it very, very difficult to try to communicate that, hey, these are biblical teachings. But there still was a way to do this, and as you go back and you look at the history of the Sadducees, you find that the rabbis for years had tried to discuss these matters with the Sadducees, and they've been unsuccessful. So if you've got that kind of track record where you're using arguments that people simply can't beat, well, Jesus is probably also going to fail. So you kind of have to have that in mind as we look at Matthew 22, verses 23 through 28. And let's read those verses now. On that day, there came to him Sadducees, they that say there is no resurrection. And they asked him, saying, Teacher, Moses said, if a man die having no children, his brother shall marry his wife and raise up seed unto his brother. Now there were with us seven brethren, and the first married and deceased, and having no seed left his wife unto his brother. In like manner the second also, and the third unto the seventh. And after them all the woman died. In the resurrection, therefore, whose wife shall she be of the seven? For they all had her. Okay, the Sadducees may have known that Jesus believed in and taught about a future resurrection. That certainly seems to be a teaching that you find on his lips at various times. John 5, 28 and 29, he said, Marvel not at this, the hour cometh in which all they that are in the tombs shall hear his voice and come forth. They that have done good unto the resurrection of life. So he specifically taught about that on some occasions. And here you have these fellows coming to Jesus and they ask about a practice which is known as the Levirate law. When you look at this particular law, you do not want to associate it with the tribe of Levi. That's not what's being said. In fact, if you go back, let's have somebody go back to the book of Genesis for a second. Genesis 38, verse 8. I cite this passage to show you that this particular law or this practice might be a better word, was in existence even before Moses' law came into creation, long before Moses' law came along. Genesis 38, verse 8. Somebody have it and want to read it? Brian, Tina, I think you were up first.
And Judah said to Onan, go in
Go in to your brother's wife and marry her, and raise up an heir to your brother.
All right, that's a good statement of what this practice was designed to do. A woman gets married, and especially for the Jews, how important was it to have a son? Big deal. If you didn't have a son, what happened?
Inheritance.
Family line gets wiped out. Inheritance issues. I did not realize this until I joined the military, and I suppose it is still in existence. But there is a provision in the military that is described with something like sole surviving son. If you are the only male heir in the family, the military, at least 20 plus years ago, had a provision that said, we don't want you to be killed. You could be discharged or some other things to make sure that that family line stayed intact, at least the possibility of that. Well, in this particular case, if a lady got married and she did not have any children to prevent that family line from being lost in the event that her husband dies, what happens? From within that family, there's a brother. And that brother is supposed to do what? All right, he's going to go ahead and make her his wife so they can have children, and then that family line can continue. And as you look at this information, it's also in Deuteronomy 25, verses 5 through 10. That would have been, of course, the reference that the Sadducees were referring back to. Once a son came from that union, that son would have been regarded as the child of the deceased husband. So it really was a way of trying to keep the family line going. These fellows, as you see, certainly would have been familiar with this practice. Remember, they believed in the first five books of the Old Testament. Deuteronomy was that fifth book. So they appealed to this practice to substantiate their denial of a future resurrection. And as you look at their denial, it's really a denial based on absurdity. Today, people with religious things and other items can ask you a question that, I mean, it's just stupid or ignorant. And it's not really a question that's designed to, seek knowledge. It's a question to do what?
Trick.
All right, trick you, make you look like an idiot, or to say the belief that you have cannot be true. And here's an illustration of that. I think there's a practical lesson in that today. If people cannot respond to a belief, or if they cannot successfully challenge an idea, oftentimes what do they reply with? If I can't match your logic, if I can't answer your argument,
that's just your view.
Well, okay, sometimes people just try to have a dismissive statement. It's just your view, and it's your opinion, and we all have different beliefs. That's one of the common things that we see. Anything else?
Ridicule.
All right, I think that's going to be the other leading answer that we would have to put in here. People will try to ridicule you, or humiliate you, or embarrass you in some way, because there are really no other options for them. So you have this kind of ridicule or preposterous argumentation being used at different times. One of the questions that I wonder about a little bit as I look at this account is, had this question ever been asked before? We don't know. It may be that the question about this woman being married to seven different brothers was something that they came up with, a brand new item for Jesus to be challenged with. We're simply not told. All right, the situation is not difficult to understand. These Sadducees, they picture a family, seven brothers. One of the brothers marries this woman, no children. So she marries a second brother, and then she finally goes through all seven of the fellas. There is no heir. And then verse 27, the time comes when this woman dies. All of those details are straightforward, but there's a little bit more here that's implied in the story that we kind of have to dig out. And I'll just kind of lay that out with you and for you to see if you can pick up these additional couple of elements. So you've got all of these marriages, and then the implied point is, hey, there's going to be this resurrection. All right, when that happens, the implication is what concerning those seven guys? You think all seven men want her? I think the implication is yes. But which one is going to get her? I mean, if she's married to six guys, or seven fellas, and six of the guys don't want her, they didn't like her, no big deal. But if you've got seven guys that want her, and there is no evidence as far as that male child to say, this one gets her, the other six do not, what do you do? It sounds like it's going to be a catfight in eternity as far as who's going to be able to be joined with this particular woman forever and ever. Well, how realistic is the situation that the Sadducees laid out for Jesus? married to seven brothers, no children from any of the seven. I mean, that's beyond bizarre. It's almost impossible to think about that such a thing could ever happen. But this is what they lay out for the Lord. This is what they want him to answer. And Jesus is actually able to go ahead and reply to it. When you look at this question, it's really the same kind of mindset that you find with people today. Do we not find people who think that in the afterlife there are going to be the same kinds of relationships that we now have on earth? There are. People not only think that they're going to have the same kinds of relationships, but they think they're going to have their family pets, don't they? Goldfish is going to be over here, and we've got Rover over here, and all six cats in the backyard. People, for the most part, I think, do not have any conception of what heaven is going to be like. They somehow think that the things of this earth are going to be all taken up and somehow transported up there in eternity. And that's where you get into these questions as far as, will I have my pet and everything else in heaven? Jesus comes along and says this kind of thinking is absolutely wrong. I'll give you this old quote from a commentator, and then we'll see if there's anything that you want to add or ask before looking at verses 29 and 30. He said, this kind of reasoning will often meet us if we are thrown into the company with persons of a skeptical turn of mind. Some imaginary difficulty or complication, and that connected probably with some fancied state of things in the world to come, will often prove the stronghold of the unbeliever. He cannot understand it. He cannot reconcile it. It seems to him revolting and absurd. It offends his common sense. Such is the language which is often used. Well, today we hear that same kind of thing. Well, how is God going to do this? Well, how can he possibly do that? Or what can this possibly be like? Well, we don't have the answers to all those questions. But as Jesus was faced with this, he comes along and really strikes down the ideas associated with this dilemma, if you will, by saying, you do not understand the scriptures, you also do not understand God's power. Verses 29 and 30. Can't see the face there. Oh, okay, Glenda.
Did the men all die? It says she died, but did the men all die?
Yes, that's okay. What we have. They all die. She dies, so there's absolutely... Well, that's true. I mean, we can look at that from the guy's standpoint and say nobody wanted her in eternity, but you could also look at it from the lady's point of view and say she didn't want them either. But like I say, the point seems to be that they all wanted her, so who was going to be able to have her for eternity, since there's no evidence, if you will, to say she belongs to this guy because of the child. Anybody else?
Will we know each other in heaven?
I'm going to touch on that. I think that you have some information there in the Bible on that particular point. You think about Luke 16, for example, where you have a reference to Abraham's bosom. It seems pretty clear that Abraham's going to be identified. Jesus talked about Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob in the kingdom. The statement in Luke 23, today you're going to be with me in paradise, that would seem to suggest that this fellow was able to recognize the Lord. The Lord was able to recognize him. So multiple indications seem to be throughout the scripture, the Old and the New Testament. Even what we said about David's child. Remember, he said, I'm going to go to him. David was apparently under the belief that he would be able to recognize that child in eternity. Saul and Samuel, if you go back to that situation, whatever Saul saw, apparently he was still able to recognize Samuel. So time after time, I think there's plenty of evidence to draw that conclusion. We'll come to you, Sherman, in just a second. We'll pick up your other question.
Yeah, that's paradise.
Hmm?
That's paradise.
My understanding of Hades is that there are two sections. You have the punishment side and then the side that's called paradise, yes.
Paradise. So we've not given any information about heaven except what you said here.
Very, very limited information about heaven.
In the resurrection, he doesn't even say heaven, he just says
right.
For the resurrection. So in the resurrection we go to paradise, not to heaven.
Well, the resurrection, when you look at the end of Revelation, John talks about the fact that some things are going to be destroyed. He says death will be destroyed, Hades will be destroyed. So when the resurrection occurs, if Hades is destroyed at the Lord's second coming, when the resurrection occurs, people will not be able to go to that particular place because it will no longer be. So you've got the resurrection. There will be that judgment that Jesus talked about in John 5, 28 and 29. Whatever happens with the judgment, as far as people are saved, lost, then they will head off to their eternal spot.
So when the rich man was talking to Abraham, he was talking to him in paradise.
In the Hadean realm.
Not heaven.
Right. Sherman?
In the verses 29 and 30, talking about Jesus telling them about the resurrection, that are like angels of God in heaven, that this is a group of Sadducees that didn't believe in the resurrection, right?
Mm-hmm.
And Acts 23 also says they didn't believe in the angel of spirit.
Right. I mentioned that earlier. If you'd like to read that passage, if you have it handy now.
For Sadducees say there is no resurrection, no angel or spirit, but the Pharisees...
Okay, so as I mentioned earlier, the Pharisees, when it came to things like supernatural and miraculous activity, not a real deal breaker for them. Okay, we're all right with that. But the Sadducees, they would have been really the materialists of this day and time. They would say, no, no resurrection, no angels. And interestingly, Jesus deals with both of those issues here in Matthew 23, or Matthew 22. He says there will be a resurrection. And he specifically talks about angels. So you can imagine how upset these fellows were when he comes along and starts talking. And remember we talked about as far as that verb say in Matthew 22, 23? It's the present tense. So when this is one of the big ideas that somebody has, and Jesus comes along and pours water on it, and then appeals to the section of the Bible that these people say we believe, I mean, you talk about anger. These people had to be seething when he got through with them. Because he takes away two of the cherished beliefs and shows them, specifically when it comes to the resurrection, that there is life after death. Death is not the end of all. So he really took a 4x4 and just banged them over the head. But they needed it. Oh, I'm sorry, Lois.
Would this love or rotten marriage illustrated in the book of Ruth?
Yes, you do have Ruth 4 and Ruth 5. Right, and that's what happened with Boaz. He has to go back, and I'm not going to use the word research, but he has to check with some relatives to make sure that this is going to be okay because he wasn't as close as some other people were. But right, Ruth 4 and Ruth 5 is an excellent, excellent, excellent example of this. So, really good point.
Let's finish with one question on the resurrection.
Okay.
Jesus talking about resurrection to heaven or resurrection to paradise.
Okay. Let's start with life on earth right now. When we die, we will either be classified as a righteous or an unrighteous person. Now, regardless of how we're classified, my understanding of it is each one is going to go to the place called Hades. The King James uses the word hell in Luke 16, but the word in the Greek text is actually Hades. In Hades, there are two sections. There's a section for the righteous, there's a section for the unrighteous. So when people leave this life now, they go to that appropriate section and they're held there until Jesus comes back at the end of time. John 5, 28 and 29. Jesus promises when he returns, several things are going to happen. Number one, there's going to be a resurrection. That resurrection will involve several things. All the people on earth right now, they're going to be raised. All the people who are in the Hadean realm, they're going to be removed from the Hadean realm. John talks about how death, that will cease, will be terminated. He talks about the Hadean realm. He says that's going to be destroyed. So when you have that process, death and Hades are destroyed. Everybody is brought before the Lord at the end of time. 2 Corinthians 5:10 talks about the judgment of all people. And the result of that judgment will once again, it's not so much a sentencing time there. I mean, people have already been sentenced in a sense when they go to the Hadean realm after death. But it will be a way of formalizing some things. The righteous, Matthew 25, beginning with about verse 33, will be taken away into eternal life. The unrighteous will be sent away into eternal punishment.
So when Paul says the dead in Christ shall rise first, and then everybody on earth shall rise after that, he's not talking about the grave. He's talking about the paradise.
When he talks about to the Thessalonians, when he makes that particular statement, he's referring to the end of time, when Jesus comes back. And that will be the time when Hades will cease to exist, death will cease to exist, and it's time for the judgment and everybody to head off to heaven or hell. Okay, let's move on then to... I'm sorry.
Did you get that Acts scripture that you just gave us?
It was Acts 23:8.
Yes.
Acts 23?
Oh,
verse 8. Okay, Matthew 22, let's look at verses 29 and 30. But Jesus answered and said unto them, ye do err, not knowing the scriptures nor the power of God. For in the resurrection they neither marry nor are given in marriage, but are as angels in heaven. when you think about the Sadducees, these fellows were regarded as scholars in their day and time. When it came to the Bible, these guys were the experts. So you would think if you had a religious question, these would be the go-to guys. Jesus, though, as he speaks to them, he says, "Ye do." Once again, the tense is significant. It's significant. He says, "You do err." What would you think about the tense there? You do. Continuing present tense, ongoing action. How would you feel if you were a scholar? It's one thing to say, "Oh, you messed up last week." Well, okay. Can you imagine saying to a scholar, "You're always messing up"? Ouch. No, I'm sure they did not like that. So, as I said, he really strikes them in one of the most sensitive places. Their knowledge, their beliefs about angels, their beliefs about a resurrection, and they had to be really, really angry. The word "err" is an interesting word. It has different senses in the New Testament. Here it would seem to describe people who are mistaken, people who are misguided, people who are not believing the right things. Some of the other ways that it's used in the New Testament, you may remember in Matthew 18, verse 12, Jesus talks about the 99 sheep that didn't leave the right spot, but there was the one sheep that erred. He went astray. He left the way that was right. Well, it's the same word that's used here. When Jesus talked about the destruction of Jerusalem and the end of the world in Matthew chapter 24, Matthew 24:4, he talks about people being led astray. He said, do not be led astray. It's the same word. Paul, 1 Corinthians 6, verse 9, said he did not want the Corinthians to be deceived. I don't want you to be led astray. Same word that we have here in Matthew chapter 22. And John, 1 John chapter 1, verse 8, he said, those who are deceived do not have the truth. Such was also true for these men. There was sufficient evidence, and we'll see this as we go through the material, there was sufficient evidence for the Sadducees to believe in things like the resurrection, verses 31 and 32. But what was the problem? Why had these fellows erred? All right, same reason today, isn't it? People do not know the Bible. When someone does not know the Scriptures, they're going to err. When you think about that, this error can really fall into one of two categories. Some of the error would be willful, wouldn't it? There are some people who could know and maybe even do know the truth, but for whatever reason they say, we don't want to know, we don't want to believe it, we don't want to do it. Then you have the other category, which would be you have people who are ignorant. Not stupid, but they simply, for whatever reason, do not know. And they may learn the truth one day and be willing to obey it, maybe not. But these fellows, they certainly had access to it. They should have known the way that was right, and they should have followed that and taught that, but they simply refused to do it. When Jesus said, and here again is another strike at these fellows, when he said, "You do not know the Scriptures, nor the power of God," he used a perfect tense verb. Let the force of that sink in. Remember what the perfect tense means? There was an action. Jesus died for man's sins. That's my illustration for the perfect tense. We've used that many times. Remember, that means he died when? Way back when. And that perfect tense continues to reach forward. So when he says, "You do not know the Scriptures," present tense would have been bad. But when he uses that perfect tense, he says, "Hey, you didn't know them in the past, you scholars. And now, as this time has gone on and on and on and on, you are still ignorant."
But you make it right in the
Bible. Yeah. Can you imagine how you would have felt if you were a scholar in that day and time? Can you imagine what it would have been like if you're standing there and Jesus is dressing you down in front of the other people? Your students? You're supposed to be the cream of the crop. You're supposed to be the fellas that can trick this carpenter from Galilee. And yet Jesus cleaned their plow. So when you look at this particular reply by Jesus, well, in fact, all the replies here, as far as the questions that he was asked and the answers that he gave, it really is an amazing thing.
Are the Sadducees happy that he told them?
Yeah, I think they had a reaction, but I wouldn't classify it as happy. Yeah. Yeah, some sparks flew. Let's just leave it at that. When you look at our world, various cultures have had different beliefs about the afterlife. Can you think of some?
Reincarnation.
All right, that's going to be one.
Hell.
there would be some ideas in the world that would say we're going to come back. And with reincarnation, many times people think that we're going to, if you've been good, you can't go back. You can't regress. You're always, you know, if you came as a lightning bug, next time you might be a cricket. You're going to be just kind of moving up the chain, or a raccoon or something. But there are some people who have that idea. Other ideas about life after death? Let's see, I had two or three. Scott, I think you were... Okay, there would be some people that strictly have a materialistic view that life on earth is it, and once it's done, you're gone. Sadducees would have been in that category.
The Mormons believe you're married for life and eternity.
All right. There would be some who would have sort of a materialistic view of the afterlife, and that's really the question of the Sadducees. They're saying, if you believe that, then how would this work? Explain to us how in material terms all of this would come out. What about the Indians? They thought if you go off to the afterlife, you're going to be in the spirit world and the happy hunting grounds, right? The Vikings also had some beliefs about an afterlife. They thought that it was going to be a place where you could fight all day and feast all night. The Quran, the Islamic faith, this is a translation from Asad, Surah 36, verse 56, it says, "In happiness will they and their spouses on couches recline." We have a lot of people who are Muslims today, and if you listen to Muslims speak about the afterlife, it is a very materialistic afterlife. That quote shows that. People, men, and their spouses, plural, are going to recline. They're going to have this life of ease and comfort. Well,
is that just simple, though, or do they really believe that?
Well,
that's Revelation that describes heaven.
I think if you talk... Right. I think if you talk to the Muslims, and you ask them if they have how literal their view of heaven is, I believe the answer is going to be it's a lot more literal than we might anticipate. One of the big promises is, and I don't remember the exact number, but they're going to have 70 or 72 virgins, and I've never heard them spiritualize that promise. I mean, they're thinking that these are actually going to be real women that they're going to be physically involved with in the afterlife. And it just sounds like it's, you know, maybe debauchery is not the right word, but it's going to be a very, very fleshly kind of existence in the afterlife.
That kind of paganism, like King Tut, he was buried with all the gold and stuff, and that, you know, his kingdom and stuff, you know, there's tombs like that that they found throughout Egypt, but the wealth was buried with the person.
They would need it.
Right.
You provide provision such as food and some other things. So that journey, you know, you've got Thebes and all the ancient Egyptian lore and ideas. They're going to have this great journey and they're going to need these provisions and help and maybe things to protect them along the way. It's rooted in that same kind of concept, just like the Vikings and everybody else. It's a very materialistic mindset. Well, Jesus is trying to say, if that's your grasp, if that's your comprehension of heaven, you have to jettison it. That's not right. That's not what heaven is going to be like. But from early times, you do see that kind of thing. The Bible talks about huge changes. 1 Corinthians 15, verses 35 through 53, Paul dedicates about 20 verses to talking about this kind of thing. You've also got some information, as we mentioned with Don's question earlier, about people recognizing one another in heaven. But here, Jesus, as you look at verse 30, he says, in the resurrection, people are going to be as, like, similar to angels. Well, angels are spirit creatures. Well, if we're going to be as or like angels, what's that tell us about our existence? We're also going to be, we're going to have a spiritual existence. The material, the earthly things that we, you know, have and use on this planet right now are confined to life here. Luke's account of this in Luke 20, verse 36 says that man will be equal to the angels after the resurrection. TV shows have made that idea popular, and I think some books have also sort of left that, you know, image with people, and oftentimes our folks can sponge up, be like sponges. They can collect, they can gather, and then conclude that, hey, that information is right, when it's simply not true. The Bible does not say that men are angels now. It does not promise that we will be angels in the future. It does say that we will be like angels. We will have some of the same qualities. There will, though, apparently still be some distinctions. There will be some things about people that if, for the lack of a better way of describing it, if you were to look at two creatures in eternity, one having lived on the earth, the other having been an angel created by God, Jesus seems to be saying it's going to be clear that this one was a human being, this one was an angel. So even though there are going to be some things that are leveled out and we're going to be on the saved are going to be on the same par or same level as angels, there will still be some distinctions in marriage. There will also be some similarities. What's Jesus say about angels and marriage? They are not. And Luke's account is also helpful in this regard. If you look at Luke 20, about verses 33 through 36, we'll ask somebody to head over there and pick up verses 34 and 35, and then verse 36 in just a moment. We know that marriage is something that is for this life. And if you remember from Romans 7, verse 2, when Paul was talking about marriage in the Old Testament law, he said, you know, when a woman's husband dies, what's true? That marriage is dissolved. It no longer exists. It's just like the old law. You're free from the old law because you've been joined to the new. And Paul says when a woman's husband dies, or in the case of a man where his wife dies, then that relationship ceases to exist. It is limited to this life. Luke 20, verses 34 through 35. Somebody there and want to read it? Betty?
And Jesus said unto them,
okay, he makes it clear that marriage is something for this life. Now, I know sometimes, and I'm not going to, in a case where someone has lost a mate, you know, run them over to Luke 20 and say, well, let's look at this. But you will find sometimes that a person who's perhaps been married for a long time, they talk about being reunited with their spouse in eternity. Well, there's going to be a reuniting of all Christians in eternity, no doubt about that. But if people are expecting to be reunited with their mate in the sense of being married, Jesus says that's not going to happen. So when we find people who have that hope, that may not be the time and place to cover this information with them, but this is what the Bible teaches. The relationship for marriage will not continue. And Jesus said something else in Luke 20. You still there, Betty? Read verse 36, if you would, please. Now, from this passage we've heard, as I mentioned before, that people in eternity, the saved, will be equal to angels. But now Jesus says, in addition to marriage not being part of eternity, what else is not going to be there? Death. Death will cease. Angels cannot die, and human beings, after the resurrection, will also be incapable of death. When we think about the elimination of marriage, there seems to me to be a couple of points implied in that. In life, why do people get married? Okay, they want to. That's a good general answer. Let's break it down a little bit. Why do they want to get married sometimes? Oh, okay. Well, that was a good answer, but we want to drill down a little deeper. Why do people want to get married?
Love.
All right, love. Well, will there be plenty of love in heaven? I don't think we're going to be short on that. So, as far as that being needed and fulfilled by marriage, we would say okay. No issue there. Why else will people marry? All right. I think that's...
Procreation.
Okay, procreation. Are we going to need to increase the population of heaven? Oh, let's just have another 10,000, you know? We'll just... got some extra thrones up here. No, it's not going to be like, it's not going to be like that. You know, Jesus said they're not given, they don't marry, they're not given in marriage. Marriage, in part, is for procreation. But that's for something here on earth. In eternity. People are not going to have offspring in hell. Nobody would want to, even if that were possible. And the same thing is also going to be true for heaven. You will have a family there that will be full, complete, perfect, and it's not going to be added to in eternity. The other answer that came from this side of the room was companionship. Well, what about in eternity? Will people need companionship through a spouse or mate?
No.
So, whether people in this life find a great deal of companionship through a mate, maybe through their children, through their friends, in eternity, it's going to be structured in such a way where those needs whatever degree that people have them, they will be perfectly fit or completed by God and the things that people find in eternity. One source said, like angels, it seems man will be sexless and immortal. Well, I'm sure about the immortal part, because we heard from Luke 20 that man's not going to be subject to death. I'm not so sure about the sexless part. I'm not sure what it's going to be like as far as gender. You would think that there would be some kind of distinction there, but angels seem to be sexless beings, so that is kind of an interesting and maybe an open question. We do know that Luke's statement about being sons of the resurrection further points out that we're not going to be the son of so-and-so or the daughter of so-and-so, but we will be a son of God, a daughter of God, a child of the resurrection. I've got a little bit more to say. This kind of takes us in a different direction, so we'll pause here and see if there's something that you'd like to add or ask before we go there. Molly?
Are we going to know our families, our children? I mean, there is just going to be one great big family. I mean, we're not going to be able to distinguish our own children or parents or...
The biological ties that we had on Earth, how fully we're going to understand that or even be concerned about it, I don't know.
But doesn't it say, though, that we will know each other and have...
Yes, you do have, as we hinted earlier, there are multiple indications.
What scripture was that you gave? 1 Corinthians what?
When you look at 1 Corinthians 15, you can start with about verse 23 and read down through about verse 35, where Paul talks about a lot of the changes. There will be a lot of changes, but those changes do not seem to imply or say that we're somehow going to lose recognition. There will still seem to be some way to recognize people after death. Think about the Transfiguration as an example. Jesus is up there with the three apostles. He's transfigured, and the Old Testament characters that show up, are they recognizable? Yeah, they were recognizable in some way. We're not exactly sure how that worked, but they certainly, you think about Jesus. He's been raised. Stephen, Acts chapter 7, he sees the Lord in the resurrected state. Once again, he's able to identify Jesus. So it may be, Molly, that in some respects, the earthly ties that we treasure so much now will be overshadowed, maybe replaced by the spiritual ties. The emphasis seems to be on the spiritual nature versus things of the flesh. And that's about as far as I can go with it. Now, I would not say that a person's going to be unable to say, well, this was my son or this was my daughter. But it doesn't seem to be, it's been a little while since I've been to a family reunion. But if you think, especially in Elkhart County, a lot of people go to the family reunion and, you're related to so-and-so and you're connected to this particular person. Heaven doesn't seem to be like the giant picnic where everybody's bringing out the family album and going through the different family ties.
Well, it says there'll be no sadness or sorrow.
If right.
You get up there and your mother or father wasn't there, or your children or whatever.
Right. The people nearest and dearest. And that could be part of that, but as I said, it seems like people are going to say, this is my family for eternity, and it is a perfect family. That much seems to be safe to say.
Regardless of who's there.
Right. And when you look, we're in this section, Revelation chapter 4. When you look at that particular chapter, it's probably the best chapter as far as what heaven is like. And you just don't see much room, in my mind, any wiggle room there to go ahead and say, well, let's sit down and trace the family genealogy. You've gotten, Don, I didn't answer your question. I wanted to deal with this a couple times. But in Revelation 4, Don asked about the thundering and the lightning that's coming from the throne. He asked about the tense of that. It's present tense. Now, when you think about that, and as I said in that class on Revelation, I do not believe that should be understood, that that's going to be banging down and it's going to be a source of irritation. But it's a way of describing power, glory, splendor. It's a very overwhelming environment. And when we are surrounded by that kind of thing today, where it is just, what's the most glorious experience that anybody can think of? Glorious, the most wonderful experience that you can think of. I mean, where you are so caught up in the moment, you say, it could not be any better than this.
Birth. Giving birth.
Okay. All right. Anybody else? I'm going to hold that one as far as an answer. Anything else? Okay. That's good. All right. Let's take all three of those. We'll start with the answer that Margaret gave. Somebody becomes a Christian. If we are really into that moment, thinking about it, maybe we're the person who's in the process of becoming a Christian. Are we thinking about, 10 generations back? That's not in our head. What are we thinking about? We're thinking about spiritual things at that particular point. Same thing with the birth. Nobody wants to go ahead and get out the genealogy book and say, well, let's see what Grandpa Joe, was doing back in 1852. No, we're concentrating on the experience. And the wedding day too, Sherman. People are thinking about, hey, this is the day where I'm being joined to this particular person. I'm going to be the bride. I'm going to be the groom. So it seems to me that you're going to have this circumstance where people are so elated, it's going to be such a glorious time, that the things that seem so important to us in this life, they're just going to be wiped away. It's not going to matter. So that's the best that I can offer there. We do want to, and we'll not have time to do this tonight, but say a few things about Genesis 6. I was recently asked about this. People were asking about the Nephilim.